This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is The Money. I'm Richard Aidy. If you're in Melbourne, you might be very focused on a haircut. Actually, plenty of people in Sydney who got out of lockdown last week still haven't had one, and they are keen. We'll hear about the haircuts and everything else people are spending their money on later in the show. Let's start with Glasgow, the big international climate change conference that now looms on the horizon. The Prime Minister wants to take a commitment to it that Australia will be at net zero by 2050. What he's been waiting for is a sign-off from the coalition partners, the Nationals. He's expected to get that, but there will be a price. Today, it's been reported the Nats will get back to him on what the price is. But as we go to air, we don't know it. To make some sense of this situation, I'm joined by one of Australia's leading economists and economic advisor to the Climate Council, Nikki Hutley. Nikki, welcome back to The Money.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
Well, let's start with what's being reported. And it's, I have to stress that it's just being reported on what the National Party wants, because it's not just money, Nikki.
Well, no, there are all sorts of things on the line, including regional infrastructure, things like extension of the inland rail with some very large price tags associated. And whilst on the one hand they're saying we can't sort of make promises 30 years into the future, they're also saying that they want things, commitments that will be more than short-term cash and to be those long-term commitments to protect regions. Of course, how we actually do that is a little bit problematic. We need to have some really strategic plans in place, because not every single coal job or reliant fossil fuel job can be replaced with, say, renewable energy in exactly the same position.
No, indeed. There's talk, I think Phil Khoury in The Fin has reported that they're after things like changes to the Environment Protection and Biodiversity Conservation Act, request for assistance and funding. You've already touched on things like inland rail. It seems to be quite an ambitious set of ideas.
Yeah, changing the Environmental Protection Act raises some alarm bells with me. And we know, of course, that the Nationals feel that they bore the brunt of Kyoto through halting of land clearing. And, you know, we want to make sure that we're, you know, net zero. You're not going to get rid of every emission, but you can't allow emissions to increase in any sector. We need everybody to come to the party. So there's a lot of work to be done. It's quite complicated. We need, you know, a lot of planning and policy on the part of the federal, state, local governments, you know, right across sectors, businesses. So it's not a simple task. A wish list is not going to necessarily cut it either.
Right. Well, at this point, I'm going to abandon journalistic tradition and stop asking you questions about what we don't know. Let's talk about something else. I want this in context, Nikki. How much is a federal net zero commitment the main game now?
Yeah, look, I get asked this question very frequently these days, because, of course, we know the states are doing amazing things. We've just had some really big announcements from New South Wales government that's just going ahead in leaps and bounds. The ACT government very quietly has gone net zero in all sorts of ways already, you know, and right around Australia we're seeing that. But what we can't have is a federal government going in the opposite direction. And one of the major things that we need to see the federal government change its policy on is fossil fuels. We can't have new gas-fired power stations. We can't have, you know, $10 billion a year in subsidies to those sectors and achieve the goals of net zero. So yes, you know, they're not the only part of this equation, and, you know, the business sector itself is moving ahead in leaps and bounds, but we can't have the federal government not only not joining the party, but actually sending the boat in the opposite directions, if I can mix my metaphors.
No, fair enough. I mean, the noise is off, certainly from Angus Taylor, have been, well, we can have the coal mines, we'll just have to, technology will sort it all out. As somebody who's been watching carbon capture and storage for more than 25 years, so far we've got very little. You mentioned business though, Nikki. How much is this change actually being driven by business?
Look, I think business are obviously getting on the front foot themselves. I mean, just the announcement this week from Rio of its own 2030 strategy, 50% reduction in emissions. You know, we've got Twiggy Forrest, you know, looking at what he's doing, even with his scope 3 emissions. So, you know, what happens to things that he's along his supply chain and things that are not necessarily directly in his control. I mean, we are seeing the business community respond to pressure from shareholders, from consumers. We've got roughly, I think it's around 20% of the ASX has got commitments in place, around similar percentage of super funds now, you know, moving funds to go get towards net zero. So they understand the business argument. You don't have to talk climate to them. This is a financial argument. There's financial risk and they're acting on it.
So actually, if we put the politics aside, as an economist, are you kind of reasonably optimistic that we're starting to at least move? Perhaps we could be moving quicker.
Yeah, look, I'm optimistic at the momentum that is gathering, but I'm alarmed that we're not going fast enough because, you know, much like COVID, when we economists listen to the health experts, you know, we also need to listen to the climate science experts. And you know, I've got a lot of colleagues on the Climate Council that are telling me some pretty dire things about how quickly we need to act. And it's not about net zero 2050 anymore, Richard. It's really what's your commitment by 2030. We cannot do this at the 11th hour. If we don't do anything in this decade, we will still get temperature rises that will leave Australians in a, you know, an absolutely appalling economic situation with climate change. So we've got to act, and we've got to act now. It is great to see businesses on the front foot, but we need more from federal government too.
That is where we'll leave it, Nikki. Thank you very much for joining us again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Richard.
Nikki Hartley is economic spokesperson for the Climate Council. We're going to stay with climate. The Glasgow conference begins on the 1st of November. It's close. But Australia's not remotely close to convincing the international investment community that we're a good place to send their money. Not on climate, anyway. That's been underlined by the release this week of a report card on 5 different metrics for each of the G20 countries. It's been put together by 3 investor groupings managing more than $60 trillion. One of them's the investor group on climate change. Here's Chief Executive Rebecca Mikola-Wright.
There's been a lot of work going on by investors for quite a while now, and how investors engage with policymakers is really critical to this. And obviously in the lead up to the Glasgow COP in 2 weeks' time, it's really critical to understand, you know, where governments and the Australian government, how it compares to other nations. And we've been putting forward our policy positions, which include all of those 5 priority actions. And so this is really a way to really clearly highlight where Australia sits compared to other G20 nations and, of course, its major trading partners.
Now, you mentioned there's 5 different things that you're measuring, 5, I suppose, priority areas for governments. The 2030 target, just talk me briefly through what different countries are doing there.
So the 2030 target is really, you know, the science says we need to get to 45% to 50% minimum reductions by 2030. So that gap from the Australian context, if we don't get those policies in place, we're already seeing our major trading partners like South Korea and Japan already putting those updated 2030 targets, you know, in place. And the inertia by Australia not moving, we're going to fall further behind as other markets move further ahead.
Mm. So net zero, which of course is the thing that the coalition is twisting itself into a big fuss about this week, that's something else that you assess the G20 countries on.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, net zero by 2050 has been the sort of the main target that people have been focusing on for some time. And that's a really important and critical policy signal. And that's what the science says, you know, is required. And that is really sort of that first point of call. We saw a number of Asian nations last year, obviously China net zero by 2060, South Korea, Japan, US, and many others by 2050. But it's really to give us an indication of how we're tracking to that 2050 goal. Mm-hmm. It's those 2030 targets. targets that are really critical as that sort of near term. And investors, you know, 2050 is a long time out. So you need to sort of work backwards from that. And it's in this next critical decade. And this is where investors are making the decisions, you know, in the next sort of 5 to 10 years, they need to make these decisions now. And so that 2030 milestone is very important.
So the third one is credible policies, which shows how connected all these different areas are. A few weeks ago on The Money, we talked about really what might happen if we did announce a net zero target. And as things stand, almost nothing, because there's nothing legislated and there's a complete policy gap. This is critical, isn't it?
Look, it's really important that we get clarity. So not only do we need that target, you know, initially, and that sends a massive signal to the market and to investors about the direction of travel for the Australian economy. But what we also really need to see is the clarity of that target. What does that cover? You know, it needs to cover all types of emissions. It needs to have the sector policy plans as part of the assessment, you know, and how this will flow through to major industries like agriculture, transport, you know, EVs and so on, and the heavy emissions sectors. So it really needs to have that flow through effect and be really a comprehensive policy to give investors and companies in those sectors that very clear direction to be able to invest with confidence to transition their companies and ultimately the Australian economy.
So the fourth one's COVID-19 recovery. I guess this is how, in recovering from the pandemic, governments choose to spend money and encourage growth. Now, of course, in Australia, we've famously talked about a gas-led recovery. We probably haven't gone as fully down the gas road as the government was talking about a year ago, but that's really what you're looking at here, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I think Australia's spending on the COVID recovery in terms of on a sustainable front is only at 2%, which is fairly tiny compared to, you know, some other nations which have got, you know, significantly, you know, up over the 50, 60, 70% in terms of its COVID-19 spending. And so that's something that is capital spending now, the long-term spending that needs to be put in place now. The reality is that it can help us out of this COVID recovery by injecting this capital, but it has to be done in a sustainable way and to help enable this transition.
And the last one was disclosure, which of course is vitally important for financial markets. Well, you've rated each of the G20 countries based on the, I suppose, the traffic light approach. So with red for worst and green for best. Which countries do worst?
So the countries that do worst are Russia, Indonesia, and Saudi Arabia. So they've got 5 reds across our traffic light system. And then you have 4 reds with Australia, Argentina, Mexico, and India. So that gives you a bit of an indication of where Australia sits in the G20 countries.
And at the other end, you've got countries like...
It doesn't look so good.
At the other end, you've got countries like France and Germany in the EU. What does it mean for us to have 4 reds and I think 1 amber? What are the consequences?
Well, the reality is these lack of climate policies is just a risk to investments and capital will leave Australia and arguably is already leaving Australia. It just creates this uncertainty for investors. And so we just can't help transition the Australian economy. And the reality is what we're missing out on is $131 billion in the next decade in clean industries and new jobs. And so that's what we won't get. But also, you know, what it will cost us if we don't act. The IGCC has done some modelling around, you know, the total investment in the economy would fall by $43 billion by 2025. And that's mainly in the regional areas compared with, you know, what we need to see for a more orderly transition scenario and having those 2030 and 2050 targets in place. And out to 2050, that adds up to about $265 billion. And really, a lot of this comes back to the regions. You know, the opportunity is there if we take it with clear policies, and the opportunity will just simply be lost without those policies in place.
Basically, you're saying that because Australia's always relied on capital inflows to do things, that essentially the people with the money will just look at Australia and go, well, you know, there's several things we assess this on, but the way they're addressing climate is just not good enough, and that money will go elsewhere.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, Australia is very dependent on, you know, international investment, and this has been highlighted very recently by the Deputy Governor of the RBA, Guy Debelle, just in a speech the other day, in addition to the Treasurer himself and many other politicians, including the Prime Minister, highlighting, you know, the risks of capital flight from Australia. It just means that international investors will be attracted to countries and the companies within them that have those really clear policy signals, and the companies are already acting and looking to transition. And that just gives them confidence for the short, medium and longer term for their investments. So when they look at Australia and the lack of coherent, you know, federal policies, it's just not there. Climate risk is investment risk, and that's very clearly understood by investors for some time now.
Well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, we know that that finance, which has a mind to this, is increasingly important, that more and more entities are focused that way, that use the climate lens as the really important one. You've already mentioned, the Prime Minister's mentioned capital and capital flight, and the RBA as well. Isn't this now really widely understood?
Yes, I would say it's very well widely understood. You know, we've heard very recently from numerous groups, from, you know, the BCA to the MCA, UN scientists and investor voices, you know, have been highlighting this with daily regularity in recent weeks. So it is very well understood, and I guess that's why, you know, there is frustration around, you know, and waiting for this update of our 2050, you know, net zero policy and a 2030 target, because investors and everybody have been really clear about what is at stake here if those policies, you know, are not put in place. And the reality is investors are already pricing in the cost of climate change, and they are already investing in line with net zero commitments by 2050. And, you know, we have 40% of our investors who've set net zero targets across their entire portfolios, and another 40% have said that they're going to do that. So investors have been, you know, moving very quickly in recent years.
So given that, what is the minimum the government can take to Glasgow and kind of get away with it?
Well, I mean, I think the committing to net zero by 2050, you know, is a start. I would say that is the very bare minimum. But, you know, the reality is the expectations are around globally. This is on the 2030 target to ensure that we can keep warming to safe levels by 2050. It's really important to, again, to see these medium-term targets to ensure that we're on track and we're not kicking the can down the road. The reality is there will be major shocks for the Australian economy, you know, if we try and decarbonise, you know, more rapidly. If we leave that window to decarbonise out too late, it'll just be much harder transition. The earlier we transition our economy, the less it will cost.
Rebecca, thank you very much for joining us today on The Money.
Pleasure, Richard. Thanks very much for having me.
Rebecca Mikula-Wright from the Investor Group on Climate Change. This is The Money with me, Richard Adie. I got a haircut last week and cannot emphasise enough what a relief it was to me, my family, and indeed the wider community. Anyway, I wasn't alone. Sydneysiders released from lockdown made haircuts a priority. But how much of one? And what else did they get up to? Lachlan Vass is an economist with Accenture.
New data shows us that at the end of the lockdown in Sydney, we saw a massive jump in spending on the sort of things that Sydneysiders had been hanging out for throughout lockdown. We can think, you know, personal care, such as going to the hairdresser and the beauty salon, travelling around Sydney to see their friends and family, and planning that overdue holiday.
Right. Well, I went to the barbers. My wife cannot go to the hairdresser until next week. But in the barbers, there was, I think, there were six of us waiting, eight different kinds of dreadful hair. How much did hairdressing pick up?
Yeah, that's the question on everyone's lips. Everyone wants to know what's happening with hairdressers. We've seen a big increase in online spending throughout the lockdown, but a haircut is something that you can't order online. You can probably order the tools to do it yourself, a bit of DIY. But that's probably going to result in an even greater need for a haircut come the end of the lockdown, maybe one of those eight kinds of dreadful hair you were talking about there. Mm. So our new data shows that this was the thing that Sydneysiders were hanging out for the most. In the first week after lockdown, spending at hairdressers and beauty salons jumped to be around five times the level they were in previous weeks.
Right.
This was a huge, huge jump.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think you mentioned moving around a bit more. What about things like cabs?
Yeah, so we know that a really important part of the lockdown tool was restricting people from moving around and potentially spreading the virus. What that meant, there was no longer people putting petrol into their cars, paying tolls to drive to work or to see their family. And no one taking cabs or ride shares back from dinner on the weekend or going to the pub. And so what we see in our data in the first week after lockdown, we see that this behaviour has changed dramatically. Spending on taxis and ride shares jumped by around 50%, and toll spending almost doubled as people started heading back out to work and to see their friends and family.
Right. My daughter, who's in her last year of school, very much wanted to go shopping. What happened with clothes stores and things like that?
Yeah, again, another really interesting one. Previous work we've done has shown a really strong surge in sales at online retailers like Amazon during the lockdown, and that appeared to be at the expense of more traditional stores such as Myer, whose sales weren't as good during the lockdown. And so the really interesting thing here is with the easing of lockdown restrictions, nothing's really changed in terms of people's ability to access some of these stores like Myer. You can shop at Myer or David Jones or Iconic online. Mm. However, in the first week after lockdown in Sydney, we saw spending at these kind of stores, department stores and clothing stores, were double compared to their pre-lockdown spending. I think this suggests that there's still some amongst us who value that in-store shopping experience. And we saw that with like long lines of queuing outside shops like Kmart on Sunday night in parts of Sydney waiting for the restrictions to ease at midnight Monday.
Yeah. I think the key word there, Lachlan, is experience. It is quite a different thing to go and have a wander around the shops. Certainly that's what my daughter was talking about, just wanting to go and have a browse, to doing the same thing online. It doesn't feel the same at all.
Yeah, definitely. And I think this data shows that people have demonstrated that they value that. They value that in-store experience. They value the ability to browse and look around and take their time and be able to pick up and feel something that they're looking at buying.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I'm in Sydney, I had the nicest weekend I've had for months. And part of that, probably the highlight, was that we went out on Saturday night and we met friends for dinner at a restaurant. And I have to say, the restaurants, it's a very kind of restaurant-y area, Crow's Nest. They all looked really busy.
Yeah, I'm very jealous of you, Richard. I'm yet to head out to a restaurant, but I'm very keen. And again, our data shows that there was a jump in spending at pubs and restaurants in the first week after lockdown. However, this jump in spending was nowhere near the level we saw in other categories like hairdressers and clothing stores that we were just talking about before. And this is likely due to a couple of reasons. Firstly, pubs and restaurants are relatively constrained in how many people they can serve at once. And unlike a hairdresser, they can't spread their consumers across the day, or that's probably not seen as acceptable to be at the pub during a workday.
Mm-hmm.
And then on top of this, COVID-related density restrictions mean that businesses are even more limited in the number of people they can serve. The other thing is we actually saw an increased spending at pubs and restaurants in the weeks leading up to lockdown easing, suggesting that some people may have been pre-booking and getting deposits down on these sort of lucrative seats and tables at restaurants and pubs. And we also saw relatively higher levels of spending at these places during lockdown than other sectors we've talked about, like hairdressers and beauty salons, as these businesses were able to pivot their offering during lockdown to more takeaway-based business.
So are all of the sectors that jumped up last week back at where they were before COVID?
Yeah, so this is a great question. So whilst the jump in spending for a lot of these businesses was much needed and overdue, spending in some of these sectors still remain below their pre-COVID levels. For example, spending on holidays is still around 20% below pre-COVID levels, as things like border uncertainty and changing rules likely weighs on people's ability to really commit to concrete holiday plans. And public transport spending is still around two-thirds below its pre-COVID level as people continue to work from home and potentially opting for private transport options such as their car or cab over catching a train with a large number of other people as a way to mitigate their risk of catching COVID.
Mm.
Then we have other sectors that are back to their pre-COVID level thanks to this jump in spending. But that's not necessarily going to make up for, I suppose, like missed or decreased sales and revenue through the lockdown period. So in this bucket, we see sectors like hospitality that we were talking about before, which may never really recoup that lost revenue from the lockdown period. And I suppose the third thing to think about here is how much of what we saw last week is a one-off sugar hit for some of these sectors, and how much will be sort of sustained over the coming weeks and months as the novelty wears off.
Come back to that, I think, Lachlan. But I'm very conscious that as we talk, Melbourne is coming out of lockdown today. It's had the longest period of lockdown in the world over the last year and a half or so. Is it likely to follow a similar pattern to Sydney?
Yeah, as an ex-Melburnian and with my family down there, this is one that's very close to my heart. And it's data that we'll be following very closely. To some degree, we'd expect to see a sharp jump in spending in Melbourne in certain sectors as people rush out to get something like a haircut. Mm. However, it may not follow the exact same trend and magnitude as we've seen in Sydney due to a number of reasons, and I think this is really interesting to unpick. So first, the degree of restriction easing in Melbourne is, from what I understand, going to be different to Sydney and probably not quite as open to start with, so it's more sort of staggered. Second, the COVID caseload and trajectory in Sydney was decreasing when they opened up, whereas in Melbourne, it appears to still be increasing. So this may weigh on the mind of some people and lead to them, you know, self-selecting and restricting their shopping and not venturing out as much. And then the third is Melbourne's had a very different experience over the last 19 months compared to Sydney-siders. They've experienced many more lockdowns. And so some data we've seen previously has showed that Melburnians appeared more hesitant in their spending coming out of previous lockdowns. And again, we might see something similar for Melburnians this time.
Well, that gets us back to where we were a few minutes ago. How sustainable, if we look at the Sydney numbers, is what you've captured? By that, I mean, are we going to be going at it at the same rate as we were last week, kind of thing?
Yeah, so as I touched on earlier, it's unclear if spending in some of these sectors can sustain the pace we've seen in the first week after lockdown. For example, how many haircuts can one get, I suppose, is a question I'm pondering at the moment.
Yeah.
So there's many factors that will dictate the sustainability of consumer spending over the coming weeks and months. One of those is the level of savings that households have, which is still above historical levels, though below what we saw in 2020 with all the government supports at the time. And so this elevated level of household savings suggests there is capacity for households to continue to spend.
Yeah.
Another one is the labour market. And we have job ads pointing to a rebounding job market in Sydney with the easing of restrictions. But how this actually plays out over time in the actual labour market will have a big impact on people's spending, as obviously employment opportunities or a lack of employment opportunities could put a handbrake on household spending. And then the other major factor is probably around government support and what the impact of that withdrawal means. For example, with the COVID disaster support payment from the government, I think there was over 1 million people in New South Wales on that support payment through this previous lockdown. And obviously that's going to be withdrawn as restrictions are eased. And that will obviously have a big impact on the money that people have available to spend and will dictate potentially what spending looks like, I suppose, sustainably over the coming weeks and months.
Well, I think that gets us to something. This is going forward. Have these lockdowns changed whether we buy different things or whether we buy them in different ways?
Yeah, I don't think we have a definitive answer to this. Previous analysis we've done shows that there's been a big rise in things like spending on consumer electronics, pets, and alcoholic beverages during lockdowns as people substitute their spending away from traditional things to things that they can enjoy in their home. And we saw that across Sydney and Melbourne through the 2021 lockdowns. Things that we saw in the initial lockdowns in 2020, such as big spending on homewares and home offices, we saw less of that in the 2021 lockdown, suggesting that that was more of a one-off consumption behaviour change as opposed to a longer-term consumption behaviour change. So in terms of our spending on things that are in-home, like food delivery, alcoholic beverages, and spending on our pets, that's going to take time to wait and see as these restrictions ease, whether people continue spending their money on these type of things. And the first week of data from Sydney shows spending on food delivery and supermarket spending has actually held up and not decreased as people try to spend more time outside of the home, which is quite interesting.
Mm.
To your other question about how we buy them, again, this is a really interesting question that we've done some analysis on. And we've shown that during the lockdown, pure online retailers like Amazon have done really well as people are not able to physically go to bricks and mortar stores. And the ABS data shows a really profound change from Australian consumers in this respect. Before COVID, we spent around 11% of our consumption of non-food retail online, whereas now, in the most recent month, that's jumped to 25%.
Wow.
And so that suggests there's a big change in the way we consume and how we buy things. But again, only time will tell whether that's going to be a permanent behaviour change or whether we revert back to the safety of bricks and mortar stores.
Lachlan, this has been fascinating. Thank you very much for joining you today.
No worries, Richard. Thanks for having me on.
Lachlan Vass from Accenture. And that's it for this week. The Money is produced by Belinda Summer. Our sound engineer is Nathan Turnbull. I'm Richard Addy.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.